Shalom, and welcome again to another edition of Seekers of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. I am your host, Rabbi Richard Address. These are podcasts that are presented to help explore the implication of the longevity revolution on our congregations and our community. And we invite you to visit our website, jewishsacredaging.com, as well as visit our Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging on Facebook. And if you'd like to leave us a comment, just address it to Rabbi Address at jewishsacredaging.com. And you can leave a voicemail message on the homepage by just conveniently clicking on the voicemail icon to the right-hand section of the homepage. The Festival of Sukkot, one of the three major festivals that we have in the Jewish year, highlighted by a variety of contemporary interpretations. And to that, we welcome to the microphone for today's edition of Seekers of Meaning, a friend of the show and known to many of you, Rabbi Arthur Waskow from the Shalom Center here in Greater Philadelphia, to talk about a project that has extremely important and contemporary implications and is linked to Sukkot, the Sukkot for Climate Healing. First of all, Arthur Waskow, welcome back. Welcome back to Seekers of Meaning, and I hope you're okay. How you doing, Arthur?
I'm doing fine. Shalom Aleichem to you and to all your listeners. And thank you for inviting me to share what we're doing.
Well, let's get right to it. The Festival of Sukkot, Harvest Festival, the Lulav, the Etrog, having a wonderful dinner outside under the Sukkah, looking at the stars. The implications, however, for what you're trying to do are very, very deeply profound and extremely contemporary. What is this program that you're talking about?
The program we're calling with a hashtag, Sukkot for Climate Healing, for the numeral for hashtag Sukkot, numeral for climate healing. And the point is that in many ways, all the festivals and surely Sukkot are deeply interwoven with the earth, the whole earth. The two Hebrew words that are so wonderful about earth and human being, Adama for earth and Adam for human being, Adam, Adama, the two words are interwoven. And I love it because the point is that the two realities are interwoven. Humanity and earth, you might even say the best word for human beings, if you were trying to say in English what the Hebrew says, the best word for human being would be earthling. But everybody thinks that's a kind of a woo-woo word in English nowadays.
Right.
But it would really be the only way you could say it in English, Adam, Adama. The Sukkah and the whole festival of Sukkot is intended to bring us as close within a human-made habitation, as close to the earth as you can be. You can't go in a cave and say it's a sukkah. You can't just sit under a tree and say it's a sukkah. There has to be a human made aspect of what you're doing, but that human made housing. When I wrote Seasons of Our Joy, the book I wrote about the whole cycle of the festivals, like about 35 years ago, the publishers told me I had to have a glossary of English and, Yiddish and Hebrew words. So I wrote the glossary, and for Sukkah, I wrote hut with a leafy roof. When it came back from the printer, it said Sukkah, hut with a leaky roof. And I figured that was even truer. It was like God's typographical correction of my typographical error that I thought was leafy. Really, the point is both leafy and leaky. It's leaky because it's open to the wind, to the sun, to the rain. So that's true about Sukkot, the festival, the harvest festival. And the question is, if that's what we inherit from Torah, the question is, what are we facing as Adam, as human beings, with the Adama, the earth, today. And what we're facing is the most dangerous crisis in all of human history. Ever since the human race, Homo sapiens, I sometimes think Homo not so sapiens, not so wise, came out of the African birthplace of humanity, since then, we have not faced anything like now, where we ourselves, the human beings, Adam, are damaging, wounding, burning, and maybe lethally, maybe in death-destroying ways, the earth. So it seemed to me that festivals that are born from the earth ought to, at this moment of history, ought to be engaged as sacred instruments to heal the earth. Our Mother Earth needs healing. And the way in which we have created festivals to celebrate the earth should also mean to heal the earth. So it seems to me the Festival of Sukkot this year and next year and the year after that and on for about the next 30 or 40 years in order to heal enough that we are not in terrible danger anymore of the climate crisis, the what I call global scorching. Global warming is too much too comforting. It ain't just warming. It's scorching. It's burning. So what seemed to me is that we should use the prayers. Many of the prayers for Sukkot are actually about saving us, the earth, and especially human beings, from plagues, the kinds of plagues that Pharaoh brought on the Israelite people 3,000 years ago or thereabouts. The prayers say, please save us from locusts, please save us from frogs, please save us from palmer worms, whatever they were. And I think we need to say, please save us from burning fossil fuels that pollute and destroy the atmosphere, heat the planet beyond our ability to stand it. And also, not so incidentally, impose epidemics of asthma on neighborhoods where oil refineries and coal furnaces, not just furnaces, but coal power plants, send fumes and coal dust into the air. The asthma rates are incredibly high in those neighborhoods, mostly poor black and brown neighborhoods. So both for the sake of the planet as a whole and for the sake of all our neighbors that we actually see in neighborhoods, we should be using Sukkot to say, stop. Stop burning fossil fuels. Start renewable and renewing renewable energy. The sun, the wind, those are the great sources of renewable energy. Then I thought, okay, so having said that, if you say it in a sukkah, if you say it in your synagogue, that raises your consciousness. But what does it mean to face the modern carbon pharaohs in the government and in the big, big oil companies, really big, the most wealthy corporations in the world? And I began to imagine taking the lulav and the etrog, the lemon-like fruit. It's called the etrog, or in English, the citron, and the three branches, the myrtle, the willow, and the palm branches, and we wave them in the seven directions of the world. And if people wonder what are the seven directions, usually we think of six, right? Right, left, up, down, front, back, six. But they're really seven. Because the tradition says when you wave them, each time you bring it, the waving, back to your heart. So the seventh direction is inner, the inner direction. And maybe that's why Shabbat is the seventh day, because it's the inner day. So maybe in time and in space, bringing it back to your heart is the Shabbat space. So what if we took the lulav and the etrog and brought them to vigils at congressional offices, home offices, not just in Washington, but home offices? What if we took the lulav and the etrog and all the branches and waved them outside one of the major banks that is funding the big oil companies, the big carbon pharaohs of the world? What if we, in other words, took Sukkot into public space, in such a way as to challenge the people who, for the sake of enormous profits and perhaps of political power that comes from getting money from those enormous corporations, are burning up the world. So that's the basic notion of the Sukkot project that we're calling hashtag Sukkot numeral 4 climate healing. I want to add that all of the festivals could be used this way. We could take Hanukkah menorahs to the fronts of those banks, the fronts of those congressional offices during Hanukkah, day after day during Hanukkah, and light the candles there and challenge them. The Hanukkah story, or one of the Hanukkah stories, is about conserving energy, right? I mean, one day's oil met 8 days' needs. Well, in our terms, it's not even just one day's oil. It should be zero. And instead, solar panels, solarized neighborhoods, getting together in a synagogue to say, we're going to solarize the roof, not only of the synagogue, but of all the homes of the people in the synagogue. That would be the equivalent of 8 days' light for one day's oil. So those are the kinds of things it seems to me we ought to be exploring. When Pesach comes, we ought to be thinking about the plagues that Pharaoh brought, the plagues that global scorching, global burning are bringing. So that's the basics of it, Richard. I wonder how you, what you think about it, how you feel about it. And I would love if you get feedback from your listeners to hear how they feel about it, too.
Well, I want to explore with you some of the, I mean, the, and thank you for that overview. As we're recording this, the Amazon is burning. We're being told that the water temperatures of the oceans have come up significantly. The ice packs are melting, and we obviously cannot buy Greenland. And the climate itself, I think slowly now over the last couple of years, the majority of people, from what I'm reading on surveys, have now taken a look at this and said, yes, this things are changing, but it's so overwhelming. What can we do? From what I'm hearing and from what you're explaining, Sukkot for climate healing is not only the direct application of these values out into the public sphere, but I think equally equally as important is the internalization of this reality within the context of the religious community of Judaism. Now, the environment has been a growing interest amongst aspects of the Jewish community, but I'd like you to talk to specifically, if we have people listening who are members of congregations, colleagues, because we're going to be putting this on the CCAR Facebook page, and they may want to say, okay, how do I begin to actualize this program of awareness throughout the entire year? Yeah, Rabbi Waskow's idea of tying it into the festivals is really cool, but I'm so overwhelmed with doing the daily stuff. How do I get this idea into Amcha from the religious school all the way up through sermonizing and massive programs? Because that's really where, you know, on a grassroots level, some of this ideological change can take place. Give me some ideas of how a rabbi or an educator or a cantor can begin to actualize some of these ideals within their congregation.
So there are really three levels at which any congregation could operate if they chose to. This past Tisha B'Av, the first time, I think, in American Jewish history, Tisha B'Av was taken into public space, and not only for memories of sorrow and grief of the Jewish people, but sorrow and grief about refugees and immigrants being treated inhumanely, brutally, by our own government. And I don't think anybody had ever taken, not on any large number, I remember a few places but and times, but in the last 50 years, but no wave of across the Jewish community of turning Tisha B'Av into a public and publicly, you might say, political, but I think of politics as the spirituality of the whole society, the whole nation. So it's either spirituality for good, or it can be turned into a spirituality of cruelty and destruction. So that's one level at which congregations can operate. They can operate in public, and some of them do. Practically all of them operate at the individual level. And I know many congregations have something equivalent to, sometimes the same thing, as Alcoholics Anonymous. Well, I think we need something like Oilaholics Anonymous, not so anonymous, where people in a congregation get together to say, okay, what can we do? We, together, do. Can we create a neighborhood solar energy co-op? Not only this person here and that person there, but as a group of people, we negotiate with solar companies, which A, means like the cost of wholesale are always cheaper than retail, which means you save money. You save money because solarizing itself saves money. You're not paying inevitably for huge electric bills. It saves many of your neighborhoods, but our neighborhoods, because of the danger of asthma and also of strange cancers from pouring carbon and fumes and so on into the air. And it allows for the possibility of community. I mean, I would say that if you're creating a solar co-op, it should not be just a financial deal, but it should be a community. People should get together maybe once a month, maybe even for Shabbat, along with the shul, the synagogue, the chavurah, but should get together to sing, to talk about what it means to save the earth and their children. So that's a level where individuals can be empowered and encouraged by the congregation. As I said, oilaholics, people know we're all addicted to oil. But the problem is the drug lords of oil, right? I mean, there were tobacco addicts, right? And people at first thought, well, you know, you just don't like to get lung cancer, stop being an addict. But we really discovered that even tobacco addicts could get together to force the tobacco companies to change the way they behave in such a way that we reduce the number of nicotine addicts. So this, we're in the same boat on oil. One of the big oil companies, we now know, back in the 1970s, their own scientists told them that their business plan was going to burn up the world. So you would think they would say, oy, that's not a great idea. Let's figure out how to get out of our business plan and change in a new direction, put the technology into solar and into wind. They didn't do that. Instead, they created campaigns to lie, to buy politicians, to buy even scientists. We lost an entire generation of energy for political change because of that. So we need to be getting together as individuals and as communities, the synagogue itself, the Chavurah itself, can become a community for creating a solar co-op. And you also mentioned schools. So there's really something very interesting in the that we read but don't do anything else with. On the Shabbat right before Passover, right before Pesach, on Shabbat HaGadol, we read the last of the ancient Hebrew prophets, Malachi. And the last of Malachi says, I, speaking for God, Malachi says, I will send you Elijah the prophet to turn the hearts of the parents to the children and the hearts of the children to the parents, lest I come and utterly destroy the earth. Well, that's amazing. It almost seems like it was there 3,500 years ago or 2,500 years ago for our generation. What does it mean for us to bring the parents and the children together? So one thing it could mean, if we decided to do it, is that at ideally every bar or bat mitzvah, the people who are not yet bar bat mitzvah face the rest of the congregation. And the two say to each other, we will become Elijah to turn our hearts to each other about the danger of the destruction of the earth. And here's what we're going to do. You could actually make, actually the Shalom Center, we created a ceremony and then we created a set of learning processes, a curriculum for the parents and children of the families where the kid is about to become bar or bat mitzvah to learn what the story is and then to act on it. So that's a way in which at the most powerful moment, when is it when the hearts of the parents and the hearts of the children are most turned toward each other? I would say certainly bar bat mitzvah time is one of those moments. So what does it mean for them then to turn our hearts to each other in order that, as Malachi said 2,500 years ago, so that the earth will not be utterly destroyed. So those are the kinds of things. They're built in. If we open our eyes and our ears to them, they're built in to the fabric of a Jewish spiritual and religious and learning life. So I think we simply need to hear the teachings in our own tradition with open ears and eyes.
So we're speaking with Rabbi Arthur Waskow from the Shalom Center here in Greater Philadelphia about the program, hashtag Sukkot for Climate Healing, and the call for congregations and organizations to mobilize around the climate change issue. Arthur, the website, because there may be people who are listening who will say, I hear this, but can I go to someplace to get a lot of these ideas or resources? It's the Shalom Center website, which is
shalomcenter.org.
One word.
The Shalom Center, all one word, .org. We've got a number of articles, and we'll have more. We've been creating and inviting people to send us songs, prayers, new forms of the ritual. One of the wonderful things, really wonderful things, happened to me when I was 40. For the first time, I did the waving of the lulav and the etrog, and then I handed it to my son and said, "So do what I just did." So he did. So up to that point, I figured it must have been like fathers and sons, maybe mothers and daughters, but surely fathers and sons for 3,000 years of Jewish history. But then I asked him a question, which was not a traditional question. I said, "How did it feel?" And he said, "I felt like I was a tree. It was my branches that were waving in the wind. And I could smell the etrog, my own fruit I could smell." So here was this way to teach at a really profound level. at a feeling level, a spiritual level, a soul level, as well as in the mind and the hands, the way in which a human being really is part of the earth is like a tree. I've been doing recently, when I lead a retreat, and I'll be doing this, I'm going to be co-leading with my wife, Rabbi Phyllis Berman, Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur retreats in a congregation in Montreal. And one of the things I'm planning to do is for the Amida, the standing quiet prayer. It's not really silent. It's a murmured prayer, usually, to ask the congregation to go outside, find a tree, and listen to the tree's prayer. What are the different trees praying? I've done this now a number of times. And then come back and make the Amidah, the tree's Amidah, by sharing what each tree sounds like, feels like, breathes like. I mean, remember, we breathe in what the trees breathe out. If the trees and the grasses weren't breathing, we couldn't breathe. And they breathe in what we breathe out. That interbreathing, I think, by the way, that's what the Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is all about. It's not Lord and King and all that. But if you try, Rhea, if you try pronouncing Y-H-W-H, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Y-H-W-H with no vowels, so it's not Yahweh, and it's not Jehovah. But what I discovered the first time I dared to do that was if you try pronouncing it, what you get is, I don't know if this will work on the phone, but I'll try. What you get is just a breath. And I thought, oh, wow, that's amazing. Because all life on this planet breathes. The animal life and the vegetation life, we breathe each other into life. We couldn't live without breathing each other. And not so, by the way, that's the crisis we're in. The climate crisis, because the human race figured out how to create more CO2 than all the vegetation on the planet can absorb and turn back into oxygen. As a result, the CO2 clogs up the atmosphere. You can almost hear the earth saying, I can't breathe. I can't breathe. And that caught breath, that stifled, choked breath is really choking God's name. I mean, I think the climate crisis is really a crisis in God's name. And we simply have to open ourselves to that and then act on it. I mean, if God's name is in trouble, then we should be doing something to affirm and protect and heal God's name.
Arthur, I see a question about this. Given the climate and your involvement and a couple and other Jewish organizations that are trying to raise this consciousness level about the crisis, which is fairly undeniable to most people, but do you still think the common person, the person who's really not yet linked this, does not yet understand that we human beings are living and dying and thus part of nature? I mean, do you still think that people see themselves as outside of nature as opposed to just another part of nature, just a different part?
Well, certainly a lot of people do. And if you live in a big city, it gets easier and easier to forget. And yet, the Torah, in fact, the whole Tanakh, the whole Hebrew Bible, really is totally alive with that sense. They were farmers and shepherds, right? And so it's all there. And it's true that in the modern world, we push it, or we have let ourselves be pushed away from it. But when life and death, not only of individuals, plenty of individuals, there are thousands of people now killed by droughts, by floods, by superstorms, etc., and thousands, not just a few. And it looks like more, the worse the burning of the earth gets. So it's now become a crucial life and death question. And we're not used to thinking of nature as anything but, oh, we can boss it around, it'll do what we want, and it feeds us pretty well. But that ain't the truth anymore. And we have stories in our ancient tradition. I mean, Pharaoh thought he could push the earth around and human beings around too. He thought he was a god. And as near as I can tell, when Moses went to say to him, you know, let the people go, he said, says who? Like, I'm a god, says who more powerful than me? And Moses, I think, just breathes the Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, the YHWH name. And Pharaoh listens to him breathing and says, what are you talking about? I mean, all you're doing is breathing at me. What's the name of this god that you say is in charge? And Moshe and Aaron and Miriam know perfectly well the breath of life really is in charge. And it's only because Pharaoh thinks he's a god because he's got so much power and so much cruelty himself that he thinks it doesn't matter. But it did matter. I mean, the plagues were not punishments, they were consequences. I mean, if you act cruelly, it turns out if you act cruelly on a big scale, then the earth itself acts cruelly. And we're facing that now. So I know that it is harder, it's even harder now for many activist Jews who are activists about refugees and immigrants. I understand why. I am too. I got arrested twice in the last year over the issue of ICE and immigrants and refugees. So I understand it deeply. And I understand why Jews are so passionate about it. We should be. And it is also true that as laudable as that is, it has taken people's attention away from the issue that is, in fact, creating many refugees. It certainly created the droughts in Syria are what created the civil war that ended up with hundreds of thousands or millions of people becoming refugees. Some of the refugees from Central America are coming as a result of droughts and famines there. So, and, you know, everybody sort of knows, vaguely knows about chapter 25 of Leviticus, the sabbatical year, the seventh year when you're not supposed to make the earth work. But hardly anybody pays attention to the next chapter, chapter 26. Chapter 26 says, well, what happens if you won't let the earth rest? Oh, and the chapter answers truthfully, right? It says, oh, the earth gets to rest anyway on your head. It gets to rest with plagues, with famines, with floods, with fires, and with refugees. I mean, they called it exile, right? When a whole people goes in exile, that means a million refugees. So it's all there. When I read chapter 26 of Leviticus, it feels like listening to climate scientists, you know, on the front page of the newspaper last week. So it's there. And I think if congregants and rabbis would open their hearts, as I said before, their eyes and their ears and their hearts and their soul to the question, what about our children? Why was did Malachi said the children and the parents have to open their hearts to each other in order to make sure that the earth isn't destroyed? That if we can open our hearts to our children and our grandchildren, then we will realize we are part of nature. What we do matters, and what the results are matter. And I don't know what else to be able to say except that we can do it if we choose to do it. When the Sunrise Movement sat in with 150 people on Speaker Pelosi's office because she wouldn't say this was a really big emergency. She wouldn't say the Green New Deal, which weaves social justice and earth justice together, which is the only way to deal with either one of them. That she wouldn't say it. So they sat in and they put, and they were our kids, right? These were these were people in their teens, in their 20s, their early 30s. They sat in on Speaker Pelosi's office, and that put, finally, the Green New Deal on the front pages. So that's one of the things. If we go wave our Luzov and Eprog in front of the home offices of these congresspeople and the home or the branch banks that are the big national banks. I'm trying to remember. I blanked on the name of the bank. We found out is the second most. It's the bank with California.
I think you wrote it as Wells Fargo.
That's right. That's right. Wells Fargo, coming from the Wild West to now, they are the second biggest investor in fossil fuel companies, and they have more branches available for people to picket, to question, to ask the bank manager to tell the people in San Francisco where their headquarters are to change direction. They can stop investing in big oil and instead invest in creating solar and wind energy and all the things we need to go with it to make is available to people. We now have the technology. In fact, it's a lot cheaper than coal and about as cheap as oil and unnatural gas, fracking gas. And we need to just change the investment pattern. So that's one of the things that people can, in fact, do, as well as what they do in their own homes, as well as what they do in their own congregations and their own neighborhood. So there are many, there are sort of stacked levels from the individual person to the community of the congregation, to the broader community, to the whole society, that people can, in fact, make a difference about this. And there is still time, the scientists say, to make a big, crucial difference. But it ain't, the time is not just stretching out forever.
So we've been talking with Rabbi Arthur Waskow for the Shalom Center about the Shalom Center's new project, hashtag Sukkot, for climate healing. And you can get more information and a lot of the resources that Arthur was referring to by going to the website, www.theshalomcenter.org, when you can pick up some more information. And the idea of stretching this idea out of this major concern, not only to Sukkot and Simchat Torah and Hoshana Rabbah, but through the other festivals of the year, gives us an opportunity really as an educator or as a colleague to really create an entire year-long consciousness-raising educational environment from children to adults. So, Arthur, thank you. Continued success. Continued good luck. Just stay healthy, and regards to your wife and the rest of the people. And again, the website is theshalomcenter.org, and the project is called hashtag Sukkot for climate healing. And again, thanks, Arthur. Take care.
Thank you.
Stay healthy.
Thank you.
And to all of you, thank you for listening to today's edition of Secrets of Meaning, the podcast of Jewish Sacred Aging. And again, we welcome your comments to me, Rabbi Address at JewishSacredAging.com, and invite you to also visit our Facebook page, Jewish Sacred Aging on Facebook. And a reminder that if you'd like to make a tax-free donation to Jewish Sacred Aging to continue our work with this project and the expansion of our Secrets of Meaning podcast, just go to the website, JewishSacredAging.com, click on the donate icon at the top of the page. And I'm very grateful for all of your support. Secrets of Meaning is recorded at the studios of Lubetkin Media Companies here in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. And a big thank you and toda rabah to our producer, Steve Lubetkin. Thank you again for listening. I'm your host, Rabbi Richard Address, and I look forward to greeting you on our next Secrets of Meaning. And to all of you, Shalom.